I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this last day of November already. Hour one of our program today, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, U.S.-Russian relations, the Russian hacking of emails from the Democratic National Committee, their promotion of fake news, finding a way to cooperate with Russia to end the war in Syria, among the topics we will be discussing this hour. Our guest is Professor Lisa Baglione, a professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph's University. She has taken several trips to Russia and has written about elections, democratization, economic transformation, and labor reforms there. She is currently researching and writing about Russia's attempts to subdue conflict and control terrorism, and we are going to talk with her about a variety of topics. She became interested in U.S.-Soviet relations as a young person, and that interest inspired her to become a political scientist. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we talk about all of these topics. Here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Professor Baglione, thanks so much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you with us. Let's start with the elections, because they've been so much front and center in looking at U.S.-Soviet relations. How extensive was Russian hacking of DNC material, promotion of fake news, and anything else? Do we have reason to be concerned about their influencing U.S. elections, potentially? And did they?
Well, of course, we can't know exactly what kind of influence they had. But certainly the U.S. intelligence says that they did, that Russian officials were involved in the hacking of the Democratic National Committee and some other officials. And then starting on October 7th, they began, or WikiLeaks began releasing emails and the information. And those came out in a pretty steady stream. And that stream led to a lot of discouragement, you might claim, in among some Democratic circles, especially Sanders voters, we think. And then this helped to fuel concerns that Secretary Clinton was not honest and had problems, and it might have driven down turnout. We just don't know. As you noted too, the Russians have been linked with attempts at what some people call information warfare, this provision of lots of false stories. And we've seen some links coming out from Macedonia and from even in places in the United States where people use social media attach of an inflammatory title, mm-hmm. and report on news that maybe isn't even true at all. And this, again, gets repeated over and over again. And so there is a real serious sense that there was interference, certainly.
Mm-hmm. New York Magazine had a piece speculating that hacked voting machines may have tipped November's presidential election. I understand that the Clinton campaign has looked into that and found that not to be the case. Are you assured that they did not hack voting machines?
From what I have seen, in terms of the reporting, this is not what my area of expertise, but from what I have seen, most officials, American officials, feel very confident that the machines were safe, that the machines were not affected, and so that in that sense, the vote wasn't affected.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess you have to ask the question, why would Russian agencies want to become involved in the U.S. election in any fashion?
Yes, that is a good question. And it helps to achieve a couple goals of the Russians, you could say. One is to sow doubt about the legitimacy of the American election process. The Russians have been annoyed for many years at the criticisms that Americans levy at the Russian elections. And so in this sense, to show that, well, the United States, America, electoral system is not so clean and has problems, this helps to make Russia look good by comparison, or perhaps or equal in comparison, in addition to show that Clinton and those around her are corrupt, again, helps to diffuse criticisms that some Americans have had about Putin and his entourage. in addition, there was a second part of your question, or I was going to make a second point, that, Putin made no bones about his preference for Trump, and part of that has to do with Trump's policies, and I'm sure we'll get to that later, but Putin certainly saw Clinton as someone who was going to have different views and policies that he would find difficult to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the extent of this, if you know. I have read that Russian funds, and I don't know how substantial they are, have also been supporting European far-right parties.
Yes, there's been evidence of that for a good several years now, and certainly in the aftermath of the annexation of Crimea, Vladimir Putin used funding to particular rightist leaders, extreme rightist leaders, to help convince them to come over and, for instance, certify the elections or be election watchers in Crimea during the referendum and others. But yes, there's definitely been evidence. I don't know to how much money has flowed across borders, but certainly evidence that this money has been moving and that the Russians are very interested in promoting these what we might call non-system and far-right candidates in Europe and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump, of course, during the election, expressed his admiration for Vladimir Putin. He bragged that Putin actually had called him brilliant. Actually, Putin called him impressive. What's up with that? Is Trump, as we have heard about him, just enormously flattered by this kind of attention, and so immediately you're friends with him?
Right. I can't pretend to understand everything that is going on in Donald Trump's head, but I would just assume that Putin in many ways reflects characteristics that Trump does find attractive. He speaks his mind as he sees it. He has not been afraid to use language that others previously in a Russian or Soviet setting would not have used in a formal capacity. He very much asserts a position of being strong, of acting and not apologizing. I think they have a lot in common in terms of personality and stance. And so in that sense, Trump might find Putin to be a rather like figure of a like mind.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump has also expressed his desire for better relations with Russia and with Putin. There has been some speculation that maybe a very early trip that Donald Trump will take in his presidency will be to Moscow. Do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Russian and American relations are at a low point, a very low point, and this has been, of course, brought on by multiple things, but reaching this nadir after the annexation of Crimea and then, of course, with the bombings in Syria that have been going on. So on the one hand, saying that you want to improve relations with Russia, an important country in the world, is something that, you know, should be considered. It's all a matter of how we improve them, on what terms, and I think that's going to be very interesting for Mr. Trump, President-elect Trump, to think about, and what the foreign policy team that he establishes, we will have to see where they go. Right now, that team isn't completely set. There are some pieces in place, but we will have to see. But yes, certainly Russian-American relations could use improvement, but on what terms, at what cost, is what I would say.
Well, some of the people he's already named have pretty different ideas about U.S.-Russian relations, don't they? He's going counter to the people he has appointed, and certainly to Congress, both Democratic and Republican.
Right. This is the worry. The worry is that there has been a consensus in American politics about about, certainly about NATO, let's just start there, and the importance of Europe in American foreign policy and our commitment to NATO. And President Trump, or President-elect Trump, raised eyebrows this summer when he suggested that NATO and our commitment to NATO maybe needs to be reconsidered. Now, whether that's where he will go, and some of his officials, as you know, have suggested that, yes, we still do need to consider this commitment. We need to consider other things that are less dramatic but still related to Europe. You know, do we need to reconsider the sanctions against Ukraine and the like? So there's a lot on the table, and as you note, it'll be interesting to see what the Congress has to say about this, because it is not clear that the Congress or that the Congress would agree with a complete reassessment and repositioning of the United States from these traditional policies.
And what about Donald Trump's financial dealings in Russia? Do we know anything about that? Does he have companies there? Does he have financial dealings in some sector of the Russian economy?
From what I know, I think, I have to say, I think it's limited, but I am certainly not expert in that, so you'll have to forgive me.
The other thing, and I guess one of his sons was in Paris recently at a meeting looking at what the U.S. might do to fight the Islamic State, what we might do with Russia to fight the Islamic State, what we might do in Syria. Is there a way here to get Moscow to help the United States fight the Islamic State in a way that may be effective?
This is really complex and a real challenge, fighting the Islamic State for the United States. The way Russia interprets fighting the Islamic State is crushing the opposition in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, part of that opposition is connected to and is the Islamic State. The U.S. has not wanted to crush all of the opposition in Syria. One of the reasons is that some of that opposition was an opposition that we felt was legitimate. And another reason is that we did not want to support the Assad regime. The Assad regime has been engaged in many, many human rights abuses, and people would argue that the Russians have now contributed to that. So with respect to Syria, working together to crush the Islamic State means likely abandoning the previous American partners. I have not seen evidence of the Russians being interested in acting against the Islamic State outside of Syria, which is also, as you know, a big concern to the United States as we're trying to push them out of Mosul and other places now. So this is complicated, and when clearly the U.S. and Russia do have an interest in destroying the Islamic State, but doing it just with military force is questionable. I think many other experts wonder if that's really possible, because what feeds the Islamic State is the sense on the part of many people in that part of the world that they're being mistreated, and the force used, it seems to only inspire more.
Mm-hmm. And tell me if this is right. It would appear that Putin has said that Assad needs to be a part of a transition to some other form of government in Syria. Is that right? And can you tell me a little bit more about how close the relationship has been between Putin and Assad?
Well, the Russians have been committed to Assad, and this commitment goes back, as you probably know, for decades, right? Back to his father and to this regime, to the regime and the continuation of the regime.
Mm-hmm.
And Putin has, I mean, last year when Putin agreed to the airstrikes, in many ways he was taking a very big risk for Assad. It has turned out in his favor, but you may also recall that shortly after the Russians upped their commitment and started bombing. Then there was that terrorist incident where a Russian plane was blown out of the sky in Egypt, right? So then people were wondering, are there going to be more severe costs? The costs so far for Russia have not been severe, and the benefits of backing Assad and creating clearing Syria of opponents to Assad have right now been positive for Putin, and Putin remains committed to Assad. The human toll is just horrific, and
yes.
So Russia's strategy here seems to be to back Assad at all costs.
Mm. So the Russian people are unaware of what's going on in Aleppo.
The Russian media can spin the story so that it looks justifiable. What the Russians are doing looks justifiable on behalf of defeating the terrorists, the Islamic State, and the idea that there are innocent civilians is not coming through, right? And Russians are accustomed to this in a way. I mean, they saw this same kind of language and reacted in similar ways in their own in the battle against the Chechens in Russia itself. So the battle in the early 2000s was incredibly brutal, and Grozny, the capital city, was just bombed back to, as some people say, the Stone Age, and the Russian people tolerated that because they wanted to wipe out the terrorists and to have stability at home. And I think that that language and that narrative plays also even more easily abroad.
Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour, as we talk about the relationship between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, U.S.-Soviet relations, is there a way to work with Russia in order to end the horror that's going on in Syria, Russian influence in the American elections, all on the table this hour. And here's how you reach our conversation. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open at this very moment for you. You can send us a written message at talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where I thank you very much, and I'll respond to you by tomorrow with all your dog pictures from yesterday. They were just wonderful. The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter as well. Hey, Twitter, at K Dunn Show. To you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network. To your phone calls, our guest this hour, as we look at U.S.-Russian relations, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, and the list goes on, Professor Lisa Baglione, professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph's University. She has traveled to Russia on several occasions and is currently writing about Russia's attempts to subdue conflict and control terrorism. We start with Dave in Madison. Hi, Dave.
Yes, hello. Hello, Professor. I was wondering if you could clarify if something that I read is true. It's that there were a number of false information websites created that would satisfy, that would publish stories that would appeal to conservative and liberal biases to sow dissension within the Republican Party and within the Democratic Party, and that the false news stories that were presented into the conservative political arena pretty much went viral. But the false stories that were presented into the liberal sphere kind of withered on the vine. And doesn't that say something about the tendency of the person to repeat a falsehood? Should we make a judgment about the information based on who is saying it?
Well, you are. I have seen some of these same reports, and yes, it is very interesting that there were both falsehoods coming out with a conservative and a liberal bias, and that the ones with the conservative bias seem to have more legs, as we say. And they were repeated over and over again. I read one report that showing them being repeated even more than the actual true reports of irregularities. So it's, you know, for instance, Donald Trump's tax returns. So it is really disturbing, and it does, I think, tell us something about the ability of information, whether it's false or not, if it's appealing to people, to affect them and to be spread. And it's very disturbing for our democracy. But I think I also read that, you know, social media organizations and the media are having trouble trying to decide how to police it, right? How do you police what people write in a world, in a country which we pride ourselves on free speech? So it's a very difficult issue. I guess people like me, professors, would like people to get more information and to be listening and being wary of sources.
Right. I mean, that's also troublesome about all of this, that people would believe, no matter what side you're on, left or the right, that you would believe this information. We do need to learn to be more critical consumers of information, right?
Exactly. And I mean, that to me, it seems to, in many ways, it should have been easy for some people to discern that some of this information was false if they pay attention. But this is taking place within an environment in which you had a presidential candidate saying that the media was biased, and that it wasn't clear that the elections would be fair. So I think all of that happening in that environment creates more of this suspicion and this desire to go to alternative sources. So it all helps to sow doubts and to raise questions about the integrity of our democracy, which is, I think, the saddest part of all.
Thank you very much, Dave, for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Donald Trump said during his campaign that he might recognize Crimea as a part of Russia. He talked about people in Crimea really wanting to be a part of Russia, so he was endorsing that. Do you have any sense of if he will continue in that direction, or is everything up for grabs at the moment?
I don't know what Donald Trump will do with Crimea, but I will say that if he were to recognize it, that would set a dangerous precedent, because the border was changed with the use of force. And that's not something that the United States is supposed to approve of, and no one in the international community. There was a way to negotiate, or there could have been a way to negotiate a change of border. Donald Trump and others are right to say that the people in Crimea, many of them were interested in returning to Russia, but the way it all happened was not a legal, by international standards, an appropriate way. And so I would suggest that to sanction that, to approve of that, would be dangerous for the future.
Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit more about Vladimir Putin's fear of NATO. What's made him afraid of NATO and willing to push back against NATO?
Well, NATO in some ways has been a problem for Soviets and Russians since its inception in 1949. So Putin's problems with NATO are in a sense historic. But Putin himself and other more contemporary post-Soviets, Russians would say, why did NATO have to expand, right? NATO was created to face down the Soviet threat, to keep the West united and to have a collective defense organization. As the first NATO secretary said, it was to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down, actually, is what he said. So once the Soviet Union is gone, why do we need a NATO? Well, the United States and others felt NATO was needed to still secure the European theater. And And one of the reasons that the Russians are so upset about NATO is that in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union, many of the East Europeans wanted to join NATO because they felt insecure relative to Russia. They felt that Russia might at some point want to reconsider the independence of these former satellite states. And so they were interested in the expansion of NATO. The U.S. moved forward, and other NATO countries moved forward with that. And I have to say there are many observers who were opposed in this country, who were opposed to NATO expansion, but it did occur starting in 1999. And what Putin would say is it creates barriers and it creates the idea that Russia is an enemy, which he would say that's inappropriate. Now, NATO responds saying that, no, we're not allying against Russia. We're allying against other threats. But we could understand Russia's concerns.
Mm-hmm. And you've been there several times and have studied Russia, which has gone through a lot of changes since I've been alive, certainly. What about the grand design of Vladimir Putin? Does he want to take on much more territory? Does he long for the days of the Soviet Empire? Where is he going with everything?
Well, if I really knew that. When he first became president, he issued what was called a Millennium Message, in which he talked about, with respect to domestic issues, domestic affairs, wanting to stabilize Russia and wanting to recreate its reputation, its place in the world. He also revealed that he wanted to restrict freedoms and re-centralize. So there were those things. But in terms of his grand design in foreign affairs and in world politics, really Putin has sought to create Russia as a respected power in the world and one that has the ability to act and to be an equal of the other great power or great powers, and right now that's the United States. Does he want to amend borders? Boy, we have seen in the last few years that he looks to be, or people worry, that he is revisionist. I mean, the taking of Crimea, and the activities in eastern Ukraine, but he hasn't moved, and I should say also Georgia, incursions into Georgia. And that is the question. We don't know. And so as officials look to develop a policy as to how to deal with Putin now, they think about deterrence. We need, and there is a sense that we need to deter Putin from taking more territory. Mm. And this is why, for instance, the Baltic republics or former Baltic republics, the Baltic states, are very intent upon NATO remaining strong and the commitment to NATO, which is an attack on one, is an attack on all, remaining very credible.
Mm-hmm. How old is Putin now?
He's
in his 60s?
In his 60s,
he
yeah.
is. Okay. Steve in Phillips, Wisconsin. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hi, Steve.
My question was had to do with the media's coverage of the hacked emails. I noticed that they covered the hacked emails in the sense that they said that the Russians did the hacking, but didn't concentrate very much on the content of the emails that showed the DNC favored Hillary over Bernie. And the other part of my question would be is, has there been any further news about the connection between Hillary Clinton and Putin and that they found in the Panama Papers?
With respect to the Panama Papers, I am not sure I know anything about a connection between Clinton and Putin in the Panama Papers. So I have to say I'm not sure there. With respect to the dump of the emails from WikiLeaks and the Clinton campaign, from what I understand, those were released through WikiLeaks, and they provide at least one of the sources I have that said, you know, that there wasn't much new information, but that it was coming at a very sensitive time, mm-hmm. and that it's American agencies are verifying that or vouching for it to have come from Russian activities approved by the Russians at the highest levels. So that's the best I can do on that for you.
And in terms of the Panama Papers, I know you did shows on that. When they were released, the Clintons weren't mentioned. Hillary and Bill and Chelsea, where all their names were searched, weren't found in the Panama Papers as having investments, but associates, people they had known, were. Mm-hmm. I don't know about Putin. I you know, somewhere lodged in the back of my mind, I don't remember if the Russians were mentioned in those papers.
There were many people who with close ties with Putin who were mentioned in those papers.
Okay.
Yes,
but not Putin himself.
My recollection is no.
Okay, thanks, Steve, very much for the call. Gail in Fish Creek. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have one comment kind of into a question here. With Russia being the worst in the planet for monetary quality, and India being second and the U.S. being third, I'm wondering how Putin is taking care of his own country and his own people versus going out and looking at going after other countries and fighting the terrorists and how that's playing out.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I missed what you said. In terms of what kind of quality?
The monetary inequality in Russia is worse than any other country on the planet. So I'm wondering how is playing out in how Mr. Trump is wanting to get into a relationship with Mr. Putin because over war, because that becomes a monetary profit issue, and we know that only the super wealthy who invest in military industrial product make any profit, and that's been since Napoleon time and the Rothschilds.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay. I don't know precisely what the inequality figures are, but I do know what's really interesting is that Russia, compared to its other, the countries that are often considered similar to it, the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and those countries have experienced economic growth and transformation over the last 15 or so years. And of those countries, Russia's transformation had much less impact on the living standards of ordinary Russians than in the other BRIC countries. So that's something really to note and as important. The second part of your question, I think, goes to how is it that individuals, that ordinary Russian people, can be handling economic difficulties and economic dislocation without turning on their government. And this is very much on Putin's mind. And many analysts believe that Putin's turn toward a more nationalistic and more aggressive foreign policy stance is a way to overcome the economic difficulties that Russia is experiencing, and as a way to, in a sense, trade off economic performance with nationalism to rally the individuals, the people behind his rule. So that's something that many scholars would argue and see, that nationalism allows, and this pride in Russia's achievements and Putin as a leader is what helps to maintain his power. And I would just add that Putin's, I've checked this just before we came on, Putin's approval ratings in Russia right now are at 86%.
Really?
And isn't that amazing when you consider he's been in power for 16 years? And in addition, they haven't gone below 80% since the invasion of Crimea. So just phenomenal.
And tell me more about why that's the case.
Well, part of it is that alternatives to Putin, people who could be alternatives to Putin, are intimidated, chased away, and leave Russia. It's very hard to survive as an alternative to Putin in Russia. Mm-hmm. So there aren't viable alternatives. Part of it is that Putin has used his power to, and it's a power that's political, that's economic, that's social, to be able to link folks into his system, you know, and into the power structure, but at the cost of making sure they remain subordinate, right? So you, if you cross him, you risk losing access to power and wealth. And part of it, of course, is this amazing propaganda machine that has grown up around Putin and a basic chorus of voices in the media championing him, championing Russia's greatness, and discussing all of the evils of others and of other states that try to speak badly of him.
What is it about? We have Cuba on our mind with the death of Fidel, and what is it about the former Soviet Union? There was this time when we had perestroika, we had glasnost, we were thinking that maybe we'd see some semblance of democracy, at least capitalism when it came to the economy in a small form. It didn't seem to, it took on for just a little while and then it just, it's gone since Putin. What happened to it?
Oh boy, it's a complicated question. I'll do my best. So Gorbachev began his reforms in 1985, 86, and the Soviet Union ultimately fell at the end of 1991. And that fall of the Soviet Union unleashed different kinds of nationalism, which led to its breakup. And upon the breakup, Russia embarked on its own. And it embarked on its own as a power that needed to transform itself in multiple dimensions, politically, as you noted, economically. It had to recreate its economy, not only to make it a market, but also to, in a sense, not be an empire anymore, right? Because there had been these imperial ties. It also had to figure out its place in the world. And during the Yeltsin years, initially, for a period, Yeltsin was content and Russians were content to be seen as a partner with the West. Now, this partnership, many Russians and some Westerners would observe, was more of a junior partnership. And the extent to which that annoyed and later had an even more serious impact on Russians, it seemed to grow over the 90s, along with resentment as to the path of the economic reforms and the quality of the political reforms. For many reasons, the political reforms, although elections were instituted, and Russia in the 90s had a very vibrant media and press, and was a relatively open society, the changes that occurred did not, in terms of the political and economic results, did not help most ordinary Russians. They watched and saw certain people becoming very wealthy. They saw corruption increasing, and then they also saw these wars in Chechnya and terrorism come to Russia proper. So we have this failure in the 90s that then Putin's able to exploit and say, look at how bad things were in a, quote, liberal system. And I would say the United States and others, and not just the country, but citizens and even specialists, had an idea that the process of transformation would be much easier than it actually was.
We're going to take more phone calls. If you want to join our conversation, please feel free to do so. We're talking about U.S.-Russian relations, as Donald Trump will soon become the president of the United States and has said that he would like a closer relationship with Russia, and has expressed the Soviet president Vladimir Putin has expressed admiration for Donald Trump. There are a lot of fronts where perhaps there could be closer cooperation, but there are also major reports of Russians becoming involved in the U.S. elections. We've been talking about that, as well as the reign of Vladimir Putin, and we're welcoming your phone calls. Our phone number, a couple lines are open for you, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Well, our phone number is 800-486-8655, and our guest this hour is Professor Lisa Baglione, a professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph's University, who's right now writing about Russia's attempts to subdue conflict and also to control terrorism. Richard in Madison, our next caller. Hello, Richard.
Hi. I have a comment, I guess. Is it any wonder that the Russians would be supporting the Syrian government? Because the Syrian government provides the naval facilities for the Russians to enter the Mediterranean Sea. I mean, that's kind of strange to me that people haven't figured this out.
Right. You're making a point about the strategic relationship between Russia and Syria. But on another, you know, in other ways, we could argue that Assad's behavior has been beyond the pale. And it might have been possible earlier on to perhaps negotiate a kind of outcome if you were concerned with human rights that might preserve people in Syria. Now, in addition, we could also argue that the destabilization of Syria has led, meaning the immigration of Syria, has led to many, many migrants leaving and going to Europe, which helps to destabilize Europe and has led to the rise of the radical right there, which also serves Russia's strategic interests. So it has been an interesting achievement or development for the Russians.
Thanks, Richard. Mike in Sun Prairie. Hello, Mike. Mike, are you there? Mike, you need to turn your radio down. I'll give you another second. All right. Well, I don't know where you are, Mike, so call us back. And William in Middleton. Hi.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I went first in 1969 to Finland, Estonia, Karelia, Ingeria, which the Swedes call Ingermanland, Vepsland, and Russia. I was the first American that was not associated with the U.S. Embassy allowed to enter these areas. And what I went and talked to these people that lived in Karelia, Ingeria, Vepsland. They were all Finnish. They spoke Finnish language. And they said, we are going to be taken over by the Russians. They're coming in. They're building apartment buildings. Go in that one apartment building over there, for example. It was many stories high. But don't say a word. Don't say a word. Then come back out of there.
All right,
and I went in there. Oh, odor. It was just terrible.
I'm sorry, William, but let's get a response. We have other people who want to talk. Can you talk about Russia's relationship with Finland?
Sure. Well, I mean, people worry about the analogy of the Soviet Union's control of Finland, which it wasn't direct control, but there was pressure on Finland, right? Because the Finns knew they were right on the border. And so there was even a term for it, Finlandization, right? You have a way of the threat that Russia could be coercive was enough to modify Finn's policy. And so some folks today worry that Putin's threat of aggression could
quote, Finlandize other parts of the old Soviet Union, even without taking territory.
Hmm.
So in that sense, there is this worry of a threatening Russia.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, William, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Don in Green Bay. Hi, Don.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I was wondering if you could confirm or elaborate on the connection between the Russians and Trump's former campaign manager of money going through the Ukraine to this man. I can't remember his name.
And Manafort.
Then also,
Manafort?
And then all, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then also the relationship between Trump's daughter and a woman who's supposed to be Putin's girlfriend. How deep does this connection go between the Russians and Trump?
I never heard about the girlfriend.
Right, right.
Connection.
That one I'm not aware of.
No.
His daughter has a relationship with his girlfriend. But certainly Manafort did work for the Ukrainian candidate in 2006 and later. So, yes, he has this connection. Some folks argue that there were contacts. There have been some reports of contacts between the between the Trump campaign and the Russian administration, with even a deputy foreign minister saying, yes, there were contacts, and some folks think it might have gone through Manafort if there were, or that would be a likely channel. But then the Russian government denied, amended the comments of the deputy foreign minister. So I don't know if we can, I don't think there's any evidence out there yet that directly links Manafort to Russia and then to affecting Trump campaign, but certainly he has those. Manafort did work for the Ukrainians and the Ukrainians that are were sympathetic to Russia and Putin.
John sends this email for you. What kind of, we're expecting you to be an expert on Russian relations with everybody, but that's okay. What's the status of Russian and Chinese relations, Professor?
Oh, boy. So that's a good question. And the Russians and the Chinese know they need each other, right, in certain ways. They share a very long border, and they have interests that are in sync at times. At the UN, for instance, they can work together nicely. But they also, the Russians, worry about Chinese influence in the Far East, and that's a big concern. And so this is, again, another important strategic partner. The Russians have tried to reach out to China through its Eurasian economic system,
mm-hmm.
And want to, you know, make sure that its Central Asian, former Central Asian Republic, Central Asian states are more closely linked with Russia than with China. So, yes, that's another concern for Russia.
And Mike is back from Sun Prairie. Hi, Mike.
Oh. Hey, Donald, Putin strikes me as a true tough guy, you know, no bones about that. And Donald strikes me as a rich boy with a big mouth. How is this going to work out?
Yeah, I think you raise a really good point. We don't know, and they are very different. And while when Trump is out of office, for both men, it's easy to say, hey, you know, we have a lot in common, or we think highly of one another. I think that when they have to sit down and work together, both will find that they have interests and attitudes that are in some ways in conflict. So it will be complicated. It's not going to be easy. I don't think anybody should assume that Putin and Trump will, quote, get along and change policies just because they're of a, quote, same type. So we will just have to see. But you're absolutely right. There's nothing to say that they will necessarily be able to agree about things, because the United States and Russia have different interests in various parts of the world. They share some interests. They share the interest of trying to restrain and eliminate, reduce terrorism. They share an interest in minimizing proliferation. So these are common interests that they can, mm-hmm. they could work towards.
We'll just have to wait and see, as you say. Professor, thanks
right.
so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Professor Lisa Baglione, a professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph's University. Thanks to Chris Molina for producing this hour, and thanks to Zeb Gozman for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. News is coming up next from National Public Radio. And the second hour of our program, the third in a tremendous body of work from Blanche Wiesen Cook on Eleanor Roosevelt. This is Eleanor Roosevelt, the War Years, 1939 to 1962. She will be with us. Stay with us.